Today on Maine Calling, the past, present, and future of Social Security. 89 years ago, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed into law the Social Security Act, creating a safety net for millions. Today in Maine, one in four people receives Social Security benefits. Polls show that preserving Social Security is a top concern for voters. However, the trust fund that keeps benefits flowing is shrinking, and unless something changes, we'll not be able to pay out full benefits after 2035. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn more about the history of Social Security, its current financial standing, and proposals to keep it solvent for future generations. And we'll find out about recent updates designed to reduce barriers for those who need benefits. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. By Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It was 89 years ago today that the Social Security Act was signed into law. During this campaign year, much is being made about the future of Social Security, its solvency, and whether the funding means need to be adjusted. Well, joining me to discuss all of this, Tom Nichols, National AARP Government Affairs Director on Financial Security and Livable Communities, and Julia Endicott, Communications Director and former Social Security advocate with Disability Rights Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about Social Security and the benefits it provides, or about its financial future? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on our Facebook page or Instagram page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, the number, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for joining us today. So much to talk about in just an hour. But Julia, I want you to start with a little bit of a primer. Who depends on Social Security? I think a lot of people think about, okay, I will receive Social Security when I retire. But it's not just people who retire, and it's not everyone who is older, correct?
Yeah, so people who have disabilities and have applied for disability benefits also receive Social Security. Young people are also Social Security beneficiaries as well, depending, you know, there's some specific facts that make somebody eligible as a young person. But yeah, it's not everyone, and it's not, but it is also more than retirees. It is a huge number of folks with disabilities in Maine. The most recent data is that 9% of the working age population in Maine receives Social Security disability benefits of some kind.
That's really quite a lot of people. And I understand overall, one in four people in Maine. Julia, tell me about what qualifies somebody to, I suspect it's going to be a complicated answer, but what qualifies somebody who is of what you phrased working age to receive Social Security benefits?
Yeah, so somebody has to meet the Social Security definition of a disability, and it can be a complicated process to be found eligible. It's not something that Disability Rights Maine assists with, so it's a little bit outside, the details are a little bit outside of the scope of some of my expertise and our expertise, but you do have to meet Social Security's definition of disability, which is more specific than kind of a general understanding of what does it mean to have a disability.
All right, so I appreciate that. And I'm looking at here, a document from AARP, Tom, and it says that in Maine, 251,000 retirees are receiving Social Security benefits, and 52,833 people are receiving disability benefits. And then, of course, there's also spousal and survival benefits. So if someone has a parent who has died, they may be receiving benefits. In other words, Tom, this is really important to a lot of people. We hear a lot. I've heard my entire lifetime, and I'm Gen X, I've heard that Social Security is in trouble, that it's not going to be there when I retire. And I think young people today are hearing that message even louder and more clearly. Tell us, is that true? Is it in trouble, and will it survive?
Well, thanks for having me, Jennifer. I appreciate it. And as a fellow Gen Xer, I think I've heard the same thing for my entire life as well. And so I'm happy to be here to talk about sort of what the real financial status is of Social Security. So I guess first and foremost, we should say that yes, it is having, it does have a financial issue in the future, right? But let me be very clear at the outset, it's not going broke, it's not going away. I think that those are these two things get conflated with each other, that there is some financial difficulty that needs to be addressed, but that does not mean that Social Security is going broke or going away. So every year there are folks who are responsible for overseeing the finances of the Social Security program, and they are called the Social Security Trustees. And every year they do a report that actually looks at and projects what Social Security's finances are going to be well out into the future, actually for the next 75 years. So their most recent trustees report makes very clear that first and foremost, Social Security can pay 100% of promised benefits until 2035. And then without any changes from Congress, which is unlikely, let me be clear that I do really believe that Congress will act prior to 2035. But let's say, for instance, that they don't. What happens then? So if there is no action, Social Security benefits would be reduced by 17%, which means, of course, then that there is still 83% of promised benefits that are payable in 2035. And while that is reduced a little bit, it goes down to 73%, but that's all the way out in 2098. So let's be clear that even with the financial hurdle that we have, which is to get past this 2035 mandatory 17% reduction in benefits if nothing is done, Social Security never goes away. Even without any changes, it pays 83% of benefits, and then all the way out for the entire century, almost three quarters of benefits.
All right. Well, I want to talk a little bit about potential fixes in just a minute. But first, on the line with us now is Giovanna Gray Lockhart, who is Executive Director of the Francis Perkins Center in Newcastle. Giovanna, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Great to be here.
Remind us about the role Frances Perkins played in establishing Social Security. I understand she is often referred to as the mother of Social Security.
That's right. It was Franklin Delano Roosevelt who tapped Perkins to be labor secretary, and she stayed in his cabinet for 12 years. And in that time, she really pushed for the Social Security Act. Creating that safety net for folks during what was, you know, a very, very stressful time in our country's history. You know, economic security was top of mind for her. You know, Frances believed that it's the government, you know, it's the people that matter to the government, and it's the government's responsibility to give its people the best possible life. And that act was how she put that into practice and into law.
And remind our listeners what it was like, not just because of the Great Depression in 1935, mm-hmm. But even before that, what it was like for many, many retired people, or I should even say people who are mm-hmm. older than 65 or 70, if they were lucky enough to live that long in America.
I mean, there were no plans for people. There was no savings program. There was no retirement savings. I mean, you had to rely on the generosity of your neighbors or your family, if you had those, to take care of you. And unfortunately, so many did not have those connections, those relations. And if they couldn't work, then, I mean, there were terrible old age farms where elderly would go to basically die. And Frances knew this. And as a trained social worker and someone who cared deeply about people and the poor, she knew that there needed to be a greater policy fix for this problem.
What was the response to Social Security when it was first proposed and enacted?
Well, I mean, she knew that it was going to, be a heavy lift for Congress. But by the time the bill came to a vote, it was hugely popular. It had 371-33 in the House and 77-6 in the Senate. And, I think while she doesn't get a lot of credit for this, we're trying to change that. She was the one working Congress, working the phones, making sure that everyone felt bought in so that this would pass in a really positive way with a mandate. And then upon her, pretty soon before she died, she was asked about the Social Security Act and its history. And she said, it's probably going to be amended many, many times, as it was amended many, many times before it was passed. And that it is popular, and that hopefully that popularity will withstand generations, because again, it goes back to this, true American values of taking care of one another, the community values to keep people afloat and create a level playing field for everyone in America.
And Giovanna, I know that Frances Perkins was not just the architect of Social Security, but also the person behind the idea of the 40-hour work week. I want to ask you about the current happenings at the Frances Perkins home up in Newcastle. There's a movement to make it a national monument, right? You've applied. What is the basis for the application and what's the timeline?
Sure. Well, as you know, we are here in Newcastle, Maine. I'm speaking to you from the Frances Perkins homestead on River Road, and we are a national historic landmark and privately owned by our nonprofit organization. But we believe that by making this a national monument, more people will learn about and be inspired by Frances Perkins and everything that her life, her body of work, her accomplishments have to teach us. We have launched a campaign and we're asking Mainers to sign the petition. You can do that at our website, francisperkinscenter.org. And we're feeling really hopeful that recognizing America's first woman cabinet member under the National Park System will be a reality. And we look forward to welcoming people here and educating them about Frances Perkins and her policies.
Well, Giovanna, thank you so much for calling in. Giovanna Gray Lockhart, Executive Director of the Frances Perkins Center. So much to talk about. Julia, I want to turn to you. I understand that very recently there were some changes made to sort of eliminate some of the barriers to receiving Social Security. Tell us, if you can, who those were designed to help and if they've been effective so far.
Yeah, so a lot of those changes, they're pretty new, issued in the spring into the summer of 2024 by the new Commissioner of Social Security. So one of the biggest ones that impacts a lot of folks that we're working with is some changes around overpayment recovery. Social Security previously withheld, so if somebody was overpaid by Social Security, meaning they received a check that they shouldn't have, they have to pay that back. And this can be a huge problem for folks. There's a lot of systemic barriers just in terms of reporting that result in the creation of overpayments in the first place. So just kind of putting that aside, what the Social Security Administration has done is that for people who have a Title II overpayment, SSDI overpayment, the previous withholding was 100% of your check. So you'd lose all of your check very quickly in recovery. Now it's 10% or $10, which is a really big difference in being able to repay a debt without an immediate loss of your income. So we're really encouraged by that. There's also been changes in terms of how SSI how Social Security is counting in-kind food for SSI recipients, so supplemental security insurance recipients, which is also a big change, and will also reduce barriers to accessing that program. And there's a few more that I could go into, but I think generally the policy changes are really designed to reduce some of these big systemic barriers for folks that just make it really challenging and really scary to navigate their benefits, and can reinforce some of the unfortunate myths or that can come with Social Security. So we're really encouraged. There's a few more that are in process that haven't happened yet. Another one related to overpayments and fault considerations. We're waiting for some more information on that, but it's expected to come.
So just to make it really clear, we know there's been some really intensive reporting in the last year or so that Social Security has paid out billions, something like $11 billion a year in overpayments. They've been paying too much to people. Most of this is not fraud, correct? Most of this is a mistake. And what you're saying is that before, if the administration realized it made a mistake and it had paid people too much money, it wanted it all back all at once. And now the change is no more than 10% or $10 of your monthly check. So, Tom, I want to, before we go to a break, hit another big point that we want to get to before we go to listener calls. And that is, we've heard these numbers that we will not be able to continue to pay full benefits at 2035 if it continues at just how it is. So there are potential fixes. And one thing politicians talk about a lot, I've moderated lots of debates, is raising the cap. So what does that mean exactly? And would it be enough to fix it?
Yes, so very good question. And certainly one of the things that I think I hear often here in DC is the idea of raising that the current taxable maximum or the cap on the taxation of wages that go into Social Security, right? So one of the main ways, actually the main way that Social Security is funded is through the FICA tax, right? So it's through the payroll tax. That payroll tax is employees and employers both pay 6.2% of their wages up to $168,600 in 2024. And that $168,600 is known as the cap. And so you could certainly, rather than having to be $168,600, you could move that cap to other levels. You could perhaps eliminate it entirely. I will tell you that when Congress last sort of set the cap, it basically captured or applied to about 90% of wages in the country. Since that point, the folks above the cap have actually have earned more than the folks below the cap. So the current $168,600 only applies to about 82% of the wages that are out there. So there's certainly an argument for raising that cap, perhaps from $168,600 to something else. I've seen proposals that say, you know, we'll have it go to $168,000 now, have a little bit of a break, and then start again after $400,000, maybe after $250,000. There's lots of different ways to do it. And all of the different ways have an impact on whether that is enough. Chances are good that you would need other mechanisms as well to have full Social Security solvency beyond just increasing or even eliminating the cap.
All right. Well, we do need to go to a break. We'll talk about some of those other ideas in just a little bit. We're talking about Social Security on Maine Calling on its 89th anniversary. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, Social Security, its history, current status, and future. My guest, Julia Endicott, who is Communications Director with Disability Rights Maine. She is a former Social Security advocate. And Tom Nichols, Government Affairs Director on Financial Security and Livable Communities for National AARP. Share your comments and questions with a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now, Kimberly Snow, who is Senior Research Associate at the Katherine Cutler Institute at the University of Southern Maine and co-director of CAPRA, the Consortium for Aging Policy Research and Analysis. Thanks so much, Kim, for calling in. And I understand you've done a bunch of research on the differences between older men and women in terms of the income they have for meeting their needs in later life. How does this apply to Social Security benefits?
Well, thanks for having me. We have looked at American Community Survey, specifically about household income among older adults, older men and women. And what we have found is in the younger group of older adults, 65 to 74, there's not a whole lot of difference in the proportion of women and men at different income levels. But there are some disparities as you get into the older age groups. So among 75 to 84-year-olds, about 40% of women have household income of under $35,000 compared to just 25% of men in that age group. And then the disparities widen again in the 85 and older group. Over half of women, about 55% of women, have incomes under $35,000 compared to 35, 40% of men. So it's not a huge amount of money to meet your needs for housing, food, transportation, medical care, or then long-term services and supports.
And what does that mean for older women? What are you seeing on the ground, especially here in Maine?
Well, I think we're pretty familiar with the fact that women make less money than men over their lifetimes. There are lots of reasons for it, but we definitely hear about women leaving the workforce, their full-time careers, or going to part-time work, or lower-wage jobs that have more flexibility because they need to do some caregiving for family members. And it's not just for caring for young kids. It could be caring for an aging parent, an aging spouse, or just another adult family member with a disability. And so when women interrupt their full-time careers and do that, it really takes them out of the running for being able to participate in an employer's 401k plan or other retirement savings vehicle. And ultimately, that lower lifetime earnings impact the Social Security benefit that a woman will eventually have.
And Kimberly, what about a woman, especially somebody who's older, who did not work, but her husband did, and her husband is no longer alive? Does that woman receive her husband's Social Security benefits?
She does. She can receive it, but it will be a partial benefit. It won't be a full benefit. This is probably a question better asked to Tom, who is definitely the expert. But yeah, it won't be the full amount. And yet, so that woman now living alone has a less income to meet her needs, things like food and transportation, but also rainy day expenses like a roof repair. That's still going to cost the same amount, no matter if you are a married person or a single person receiving that Social Security benefit. So when that amount decreases for someone who loses their spouse and then they receive that sort of reduced Social Security benefit, that really has an impact. It really can make the difference between that woman being able to stay safely in her home or having to move somewhere else.
Kimberly, thank you so much for calling in and being part of the program. Kimberly Snow, Senior Research Associate with USM's Katherine Cutler Institute and co-director of the Consortium for Aging Policy Research and Analysis, or CAPRA. I wanted to return, Tom, to what we were talking about before the break a little bit, potential fixes for Social Security. We mentioned that many people have thrown about the idea of somehow raising the cap or doing away with the cap altogether. What about raising the age at which people get benefits? That's another potential solution that people throw out pretty regularly.
Yes, it certainly is. So I think that, number one, it's important to note that the Social Security retirement age was raised, actually, the last time Congress did affix the Social Security in 1983, right? So for those of us who are born after 1960, our full retirement age was raised to 67, where you would get full benefits. Now, I also want to be clear, too, is that there's always the option starting at age 62 to start collecting early Social Security retirement benefits. But it is reduced depending on how much longer basically you'll be getting your Social Security benefits, right? If you collect benefits at age 62 and your full retirement age is 67, then they're paying you 5 years basically longer. So they make a reduction in those in your benefits in order to counteract that longer time you'd be getting benefits. So there certainly has been talk in Washington about further increases in the retirement age. Now, again, this is largely, like I said, about raising the cap, is that where it would be set is a decision for Congress to make. I mean, you could certainly, you know, raise it to 68, 69. It depends on, you know, Congress's ultimate decision. Often they talk about that people are living longer and they're working longer. And so therefore, that's a reason to raise the full retirement age. What I will say is that I think that while there are overall improvements to longevity, which is a wonderful thing, that's not necessarily applied equally across the board, right? So certain populations of folks do live longer. They tend to be higher income folks. And there are populations of folks who don't live longer. And so raising the retirement age across the board can have negative consequences for particular folks. And I would say that another thing to consider as well is that, again, the more you would raise the retirement age, it is essentially about a 7 or an 8% reduction in your benefits. Because again, you'd be basically receiving Social Security over a longer period of time. And so therefore they would reduce your benefits if you retired. Even if I retired at 67, if they raised it to the full retirement age, instead of me getting my full benefit, now all of a sudden my benefits are reduced by 8% because I'm retiring a year earlier than my now actual full retirement age.
Yeah. And Julia, I saw you nodding when Tom was talking. Isn't one of the issues here is that, yes, people are working longer, but some people are not able to work longer. The different jobs are different, and especially jobs that are physically taxing, someone may not be able to do until they're 68 years old.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's possible if somebody is under the retirement age and they do have a disability, they might qualify for disability benefits and they could apply for those earlier. And that's also, you'd be applying for Social Security disability insurance, which is something that pay for when you're working. So that, you know, is something that might be an option for some of those folks before collecting retirement. But again, it really depends on the person's individual circumstances, what's going to be the right option for them and the right pathway.
All right. We have two different emails that have come in that are similar, and I'm going to read them because, Tom, I think this is a really important question from Sam. I'm curious why the cap exists. Mary emailed a similar question. Why a cap? Why is there a cap anyway?
Well, good question, and thank you for it. So I believe the answer is basically that we have to look at Social Security for what it actually is, which is insurance, right? And so the idea is that for Social Security, it's insurance. And so you're only insured up to a particular level. And that is my understanding of why there would be a cap to begin with, is that because it's insurance, people would only need to be insured up to a particular level. And those who are beyond that level don't necessarily need that insurance anymore. They have probably other forms of retirement income, and so they don't necessarily need to be insured via Social Security to ensure their financial security in retirement. Like I said though earlier, is that the question is sort of where to set that insurance level. And again, the current $168,600 cap has effectively declined over the last 40 years as folks above that cap have done better in wages than folks below it.
We'll go to Joanne calling from Naples. Hi, Joanne, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you very much for this program. I'm a proud AARP member and one of the 251,000 that receive Social Security benefits as my sole income. I have heard the U.S. presidential candidates proposing eliminating a federal tax income deduction on monthly social service benefits. And my question revolves around In my case, I waited until 70 to receive my full eligible benefit. But last year, I did pay $1,200 in federal income tax. If that federal income tax requirement is withdrawn, does that eliminate the cost of living assistance that we've received? And then would that automatically boost the Medicare cost even more than estimated?
So wonderful question. And so I would say that I think that let me first start by saying that, you know, I've certainly seen the former president's proposal. It is right now a campaign proposal, and there isn't sort of legislative language that goes along with it. And sort of we would want to make sure that we waited to see what the actual details were before I could give you a really definitive answer. But let me back up and to say that, all right, so Social Security is funded by three ways, right? The FICA tax is the vast majority of how Social Security is funded. That's 90%. About 6% of funding for Social Security comes in via interest on the Treasury bonds that the Social Security Administration holds. And then about 4%, it comes in from the federal taxation of some Social Security benefits. And that last part is the part that the former president has talked about eliminating, right? The taxation on those benefits. So the thing to consider is that there about 40% of Social Security beneficiaries meet those thresholds for when you would start paying some type of federal income taxes on your Social Security benefits. Generally, you would have other things like wages in retirement, or a pension or something along those lines that puts you above those thresholds. To get to the question, if they were to make changes to the taxation of Social Security benefits, that should not have any impact on underlying COLAs, which are generated based on price inflation from year to year. So it shouldn't have any impact on that. It shouldn't have any impact on Medicare premiums. It shouldn't have any impact in those areas. What it does do, of course, is that we have to realize that since the taxation of federal benefits is one of the ways that Social Security is funded, it could have a negative impact on the trust funds.
All right. Well, Joanne, thank you for an excellent question. I'm going to ask, read another two emails here that are related. I think this is a question for you, Julia. An email from Cynthia: please discuss the WEP GPO offset of which Maine participates. I am a hybrid and a widow. My husband paid into his Social Security his entire working life. I paid into Social Security the first 15 years of my working life. I receive nothing. Again, please discuss the windfall elimination provisions, government pension offset. Someone else with a similar story. Chris, I'm a retired teacher who has paid into Maine State retirement throughout my career. I've also worked outside of teaching during summers and on weekends and had Social Security taken out of my paycheck. Why does the state of Maine feel teachers who also work in the private sector in order to make ends meet should not receive the full benefit we're entitled to? Any recommendations about how to change this law? Tom, I have to let you know that this is a question that comes up over and over again when we have Maine Calling programs on so many different topics. So many people affected by this. And this is not something Maine can change on its own, is it?
It is not. No, this is a federal provision. The government pension offset was put in place in 1977, and the windfall elimination provision put into place in those 1983 changes that I talked about earlier. So this is a very complicated topic, and one that I will probably waste all the rest of your show. Not waste, I shouldn't say that, but I would end up talking incessantly. But let me try to get through it as quickly as I can. So when we talk about the windfall elimination provision and the government pension offset, we're talking about folks who have spent some or all of their careers working in jobs where they were not paying into Social Security. Chances are good they were paying into their own public pension system, for instance, in Maine. So if you were a state Maine employee, rather than participating in Social Security, you were participating in your own public pension system. For the windfall elimination provision, those folks also spent time in their careers in jobs where they were contributing to Social Security. So when Social Security calculates your benefits, they do so by taking your top 35 years of earnings. And for what folks who spent some of their careers outside of Social Security and some of their careers inside of Social Security, right now when Social Security takes those top 35 years, there's a lot of zeros that show up because Social Security doesn't realize that you were just working outside of Social Security. So this is where it gets complicated. Social Security has what is called a progressive benefit formula, which means that for lower income workers, they actually do better in terms of the percentage of their pre-retirement income back from Social Security, as opposed to a higher income worker who does get a higher benefit, but again, they get less back in terms of their pre-retirement percentage. So the windfall elimination provision was put in place because the folks who had spent time outside of Social Security, they unintentionally look like a lower income worker than they were because, like I said, because of all those zeros or less money than they actually made show up because they weren't contributing to Social Security at the time. So that's why the windfall elimination provision was put in place. The government pension offset is that if you had spent many of your years working in a job not covered by Social Security and you were married to a spouse who was working in Social Security and you earned a spouse, you earned your own retirement benefit because of your pension and you earn a spousal benefit because of the work that your spouse did. Prior to the government pension offset, you were able to add those two numbers together, which is not the case for all Social Security beneficiaries. They would have to take the higher of either the retirement or the survivor benefit. I'm sorry, spousal benefit. And so that's why they're put in place. So let me also say that these formulas are not perfect by any means. And there's lots of conversation in Washington about how to either to repeal them entirely or to improve them with a different formula. So that is a major conversation that's happening in Washington, D.C., and one that we're obviously paying very close attention to. I would say that changes also have a cost associated with them. So it may be more likely to consider the changes within a Social Security solvency package, but that is not, that's above my pay grade.
All right. Well, these are all great questions. We have so many more great questions coming in, but we do need to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about Social Security, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, answers to your questions about Social Security. My guest, Julia Endicott with Disability Rights Maine and Tom Nichols with National AARP. Join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We're going to go to Kyle, who's calling from Fort Kent. Hi, Kyle. Go ahead.
Hi. I would like to talk about the Social Security the marriage penalty, because to get married under the God's eyes and be like everyone else, to actually get to start a family and just be happy that they have their money so they can keep living instead of being in a penalty because they want to get married.
Yeah, so you cut out a little bit, Kyle, but I'm going to have Julia explain this to us. What is what people refer to as the Social Security marriage penalty?
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. So with the Social Security marriage penalty, what happens is that if two people who receive Social Security benefits get married, one person's benefits get cut pretty significantly. And then there's also an asset test that is lower than if they were each receiving individual benefits. And so what happens in this scenario and happens to a lot of folks is that they are making less or receiving less in benefits simply because they got married to somebody else who's getting benefits. And so this is a huge problem for disability equity and equitable marriage. In the U.S., it's an issue at the federal level, and there's a lot of advocacy also at the state level. And Kyle's a really fantastic advocate on this issue and has talked to a lot of folks, both levels, about why the marriage penalty needs to be eliminated, because it does mean that people are either not able to get married who want to or are penalized simply for getting married.
Julia, what is the point of this penalty?
So You know, what the history of it, I don't know off the top of my head, but I think there's some, you know, design of when you're married, you have two incomes, right, in some way, shape, or form. Beyond that, I don't know that I can fully speak to it. With the information I have, I don't know if Tom has more on some of that fresh at hand, but the reality is that it creates further inequity for people with disabilities who get benefits. I don't know, Tom, if you want to add.
Sure. So this marriage penalty occurs under the Supplemental Security Income Program administered by Social Security, right? And so SSI is a means-tested program, and the idea is that it's a means-tested program, so you're getting financial help in order to try to meet your basic needs. And so what there's two aspects to the marriage penalty is that basically if two SSI beneficiaries are both getting the benefit amount that they are entitled to, if they get married, SSA believes that they are then sort of sharing some of their household expenses. So that is why that there's that reduction there. There's also a marriage penalty in that in order to qualify for SSI, basically you have to meet income and asset level limits, right? And so one of those limits is in the asset area, which means that if you have more than $2,000 in assets as an individual, or $3,000 in as a couple, so it's not double, right? So it's not $2,000 and $4,000, it's $2,000 and $3,000. So there's multiple aspects of the marriage penalty, and I think that a lot of it involves the sharing of household expenses.
Okay, and we have so many other questions and so little time. I do want to move on, but I want to ask, is what Kyle's talking about for people who are younger, maybe both people have a disability or one person's receiving benefits because a parent has died and one person is, I mean, or is this if two people who are 70 years old and both receiving Social Security get married?
This would be largely impacting younger folks who are receiving it based on disability.
Okay. And Kyle, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. And Kyle was mentioning Julia, were mentioning the organization Kyle is involved in. Can you tell us briefly about that so that if people want to contact them, they can?
Yeah, so there's a self-advocacy organization in Maine, Speaking Up for Us, that has done a lot of work on this topic. And you can check them out on speakingupforus.org, or it might be sufu.org. And so they've done a lot of work on the marriage penalty advocacy specifically.
Great. Thank you so much. I have two emails here that are related. These are asking about, well, let's just go to this. Bruce says Social Security was a great idea when it started. The problem has been that throughout its existence, Congress has been allowed to be too involved in its management, and they have stolen from it from the 60s. If they left it alone, it would have become self-funding and may have even funded Medicare by now. It's shameful and the fault of both parties in collusion with the other. This is what we get by allowing permanence in Congress versus term limits. And then Brian says, my history is a bit foggy, but I seem to remember Al Gore proposing to put a lockbox on Social Security receipts to prevent Congress from using the money for other purposes. What is that history? Tom, tell us, what is the history of Congress, and I'm using air quotes here, stealing from Social Security?
Yeah, so this is something that we hear about often, right? The 1960s reference is more about how Social Security is looked at in terms of the overall budget and doesn't have any impact on how the trust funds are used. Social Security moves back and forth between being considered something on budget or off budget in terms of accounting purposes in the United States government, and honestly, that change really doesn't have too much of an actual impact on Social Security other than how it's viewed. So the issue that I think a lot of people, where you talk about Social Security funds being used for other things in the government. So I had mentioned before that one of the ways that Social Security is funded is via interest on the Treasury bonds that Social Security holds. So back in 1983, when Congress made changes to Social Security, they recognized that there was going to be a very large generation of folks who were going to be retiring, right? The baby boom generation that's retiring right now. And so they realized that they started bringing in more in revenue at the time than was necessary to go out in benefits. And what they would do is that they would then save that money essentially to be used later on in order to supplement the FICA taxes to pay for 100% of promised benefits. So those excess revenues had to go somewhere, right? And so where they went is in United States Treasury bonds, which are largely considered one of, if not the safest investments in the world, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. And so, but as a function of investing in a treasury bond, no matter who invests in the treasury bond, whether it's Social Security Administration or anybody else, that money then does get used for other purposes and then gets paid back with interest. So the when we talk about that in 2035, something happens. What happens is that the reserve fund, this pile of money that's invested in treasury bonds, that's the thing that gets spent down where there won't be anything left to it. And that's all contingent on the United States paying back the treasury bonds that Social Security holds with interest.
An email here from Roger. I'm in the very fortunate position of not needing my Social Security benefits. I am 71 and I am forced to receive Social Security benefits. If I don't need them, why not let me decline or defer receiving the benefits until I need them, if ever?
So I would say, so first and foremost, congratulations. That's wonderful. I would say that, so I think we're very fortunate, I am very fortunate to work in Social Security because the program has such incredible popularity across the country, right? It's at least 85% popular, maybe even higher. And this has nothing to do with political affiliation, nothing. It's across the board popular, Democrats, Republicans, independents. I think that one of the main pillars for why Social Security is so popular is because it's an earned benefit, which means that you paid in for your entire life, every paycheck, you were paying your 6.2% of payroll taxes into Social Security, and you earned a benefit out of that. And I think it's that earned benefit that makes Social Security so popular. I would say that for those who don't need Social Security, certainly I can't tell you what to do with your money, of course. I mean, there are, I'm sure, many worthy, you know, opportunities to donate to charity. But I would say that we don't necessarily want to break this link between contributions in and benefits out, because that earned benefit is, again, why Social Security is so popular. And it really helps to make sure that Social Security is going to be there in its entirety for generations and generations to come.
An email here from Bruce. I have heard that our benefit is calculated based on our top three earning years. Is this accurate or is it done another way?
It is done another way. So it is your top 35 years of earnings that actually use to calculate your Social Security benefits. They update those, like, so for instance, you know, in 1985, let's say $30,000 is, I don't know what the equivalent of it would be in today's dollars, but they basically update those older dollars to put them into today's context, but they use your top 35 years of earnings.
All right. And before we go, Julia, I want to ask you about a conundrum I think many people with disabilities have, in that they would like to work, but they're afraid of losing their benefits.
Yeah, and actually what Tom was just saying was making me think about some of the challenges within, you know, the inflationary context related to Social Security and going back to work. So one of the things that we see is for somebody who wants to go back to work, which is often the case, there's if you get Social Security disability insurance, there's a SGA limit. And there's a number of work incentives that are designed to help people with returning to work, but there is this dollar amount that is not a lot of money, $1,550 this year. And so a lot of folks, you know, that with current wages.
So if you
wages,
make $15,000 in a year, you lose your Social Security?
$1,550 in a month.
In a month.
And you are in a month, which is which is not a lot of money, then you would lose your cash benefit. And again, there's some parameters around this. And I know we don't have time to get into all of that, but $1,550 in a month, which is really not
equivalent of $18,000 a year. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. Yeah. Not caught up with current wage rates. So that's another challenge that we see with just the calculation of SGA limits and just the calculation of benefits generally and the asset limit as well. That $2,000 asset limit that Tom mentioned hasn't been changed since 1989. So when people are thinking about going back to work, I think what's most important, and in the limited time, I just want to highlight that there's resources to help people with that process. Disability Rights Maine helps people who are Social Security beneficiaries return to work who are experiencing barriers. And Maine also has benefits counselors, which are a huge resource to help somebody really understand what going back to work could look like with their benefits to make a really informed decision. But it is challenging with the current, you know, levels based, you know, and current wage rates.
Well, Julia, thank you so much for saying that and ending that way. Julia Endicott with Disability Rights Maine and Tom Nichols with National AARP. Today's sound engineer, Sam Tracy. Maine Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.